CliffCentral.com.
South African history is absolutely fascinating, and the more we revise and discover and dig up, the more interesting it seems to get. And as we also learn from history, nothing is ever as it seems in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And someone who's made an enormous contribution to this is my guest for this morning. His name is John LeBand, and his book is called The Boer Invasion of the Zulu Kingdom, which is a really, really interesting story. And we're going to hear it not only from the side that we're used to hearing about it from, but also now from the Zulu side. And John has been working tirelessly to bring us this version. So thank you very much for your contribution to our history. It's absolutely lovely. And let's just start off with what people think they know about things like Blood River.
Ah, yes. Well, I mean, it's sort of a nation-building myth, in fact, for the Afrikaner people. It's God proving that God's on their side, this great victory against overwhelming odds. It sort of represents their right, in fact, to rule the black people of the interior of South Africa. So that is the long-standing myth. The Zulu side is more complex because Shaka is the great founder of the kingdom, and for many Zulus, for a long time, Dingaan wrecked it all. He's the guy who got defeated, who, you know, ruined the whole thing.
He's the Brutus or Cassius of the Julius Caesar that is Shaka.
This is right. So on the other hand, now there's much more of a movement when you're thinking of resistance to colonialism and so on, that in fact Dingaan is this kind of hero, in fact, who stood up to this invasion. So there's a kind of a real differentiation in the Zulu side of way of looking at things about this.
So is that a fault, or is that just what happens with history? Is that it becomes propagandized?
It's just what happens, and it's how people see history with different eyes over a long period. I mean, so you've got a change in the Zulu position, or in many ways it became politicized, where Inkatha, who espoused Shaka, he is a great founder. The ANC put more emphasis on Dingaan, just almost originally as a counterbalance to Inkatha sort of taking Shaka as their own.
Yeah, it's just amazing. You know, I was speaking to a guest just a little while ago about how history is so useful to the ideologues.
Oh, absolutely. Perfect.
And it's hard to, you know, what is truth? How do you know as a historian that you're dealing with something that's true when your sources are limited? Well, sometimes they're non-existent. You have to dig up the primary sources yourself.
Yeah. Well, you don't really. And as an historian, you know you're trying your best with what evidence you have, but you know it's your vision of it, it's your understanding of it. I mean, two historians can look at the same document and see it with different eyes or emphasize different elements of it. I mean, early on in my career, when I was beginning to look at the Zulu side of things, you realize that the information was there, say in the British documents, just other historians had filtered it out and only looked to the British side of things. So it's how you, it's what you're searching for in many ways. And
so you have to have a very thick skin as a historian, because you're going to be criticized mercilessly.
You do. I mean, you're criticized. I mean, already for this book, I know there's been criticism from people, you know, well, how dare you undo the great myth? The Zulu side of things, there's this, you're a white guy, what are you doing talking for us? You know, so one's always running into trouble of one sort or another. You don't please everybody. You can't possibly.
Well, Simon Montefiore just told me if he could go back into history, the one person he'd like to meet was Shaka. And I think there are a lot of us who would. I remember at primary school, I was in KwaZulu-Natal for primary school, and we had a significant part of the syllabus dedicated to Zulu history, which was quite good because, you know, this was during apartheid, really. I mean, I was in primary school in the late 80s. But it engendered in me this absolute fascination, and I don't think it's saying too much to say that Shaka was a kind of hero to me as a kid. I dressed up as Shaka. We went to this little fake Zulu village they'd built where they showed us how they used to live.
Shaka Land or whatever,
It was called Pezulu or something. And I remember, one of a number of them. But I remember learning about the Ikwa, and I learned all about the formations of the bull horns. And
all that.
I mean, this was, to me as a kid, this was military history of the highest order.
But You know, the irony is we actually know nothing really about Shaka. We have no idea what he looked like.
No.
You know, his antecedents we're not sure about. I mean, so there again, Shaka becomes a kind of myth as well, you know.
Well, we know, we at least know where Sezanga Kona's buried, I suppose, yeah, but we don't even know where Shaka is.
Well, no, he's...
Stanga somewhere, Stanga, but they're not sure,
yes,
right?
Well, I mean, it's near the... what used to be the magistrate's office anyway, but it's... So we've got the memorial, which is sort of where he's supposed to be, but...
But no one's digging around trying to find it.
No, dig that one up. No.
So, John, let's start with Dingaan, because if we could begin somewhere, it'll give us a place to... I want to get into some of the meat on the bones here. So Dingaan, I mean, we've always had this portrayal of him as being the traitor to his brother, half-brother.
Yeah.
That he was fat, that he was not particularly well-equipped, that he was lazy, that he was also the one who murdered Piet Retief and his men at Ungungundlovu, up on the hill of Kwamatiwan, called them a bunch of wizards, and turned against the treaty which he'd signed, which is preserved in the Church of the Vow in Maritzburg, and then went on to lead them into all kinds of real loss, defeat, tyranny, and ended up in the bushes, in a place that's literally named the bush, and died in some ignominious fashion.
That's right. I mean, but you know, I think there again, I mean, that's one way of looking at him. Another way of saying here is a highly ambitious and successful prince, whose half brother was becoming a real danger. He seized the throne with a well-formulated conspiracy. And proceeded to win over the army that is returning up from fighting Shoshangane, and consolidating the kingdom. And, you know, if it hadn't been for the invasion of the Boers, he'd have probably been a successful Zulu king. I mean, if Shaka had been faced with those 1,000 wagons coming over the Drakensberg and all the rest of it, would he have done any better? Same military system, same organization? It's a moot point. So Dingaan is someone who, in Zulu terms, was a firm king, a successful king, someone to be feared, which kings were supposed to be feared, and being confronted by this invasion, decided to deal with it, and to deal with it in his own lights as best he could. So, you know, there's nothing like failure to turn you into a fat, useless, cowardly guy, you know. Whereas on the other hand, if he'd been successful, he'd have been seen very differently. So it's...
Well, I mean, again, the parallels here with figures like Brutus and Cassius are just, I mean, extraordinary. Yeah. It's almost as if there's an ongoing human story that we can't get away from.
No, well, sure. I mean,
and brother up. Turning on brother, you know?
Well, I mean, all the Zulu kings fought contested successions. I mean, even the latest king we have. I mean, all right, now you do it in court, then you did it by killing the whole lot.
Hook and crook. So, all right, what part of the story? I'm fascinated. I happen to be four greats grandson of Piet Retief.
Oh, really?
Which people don't know because they assume that you must speak Afrikaans to
them. Yeah.
His daughter, Deborah Retief, is buried in our family graveyard.
Goodness, okay, that's
and
interesting.
And I can go through the generations that succeed, though they're much less storied.
Yeah.
I've never been to the site at Kwamatiwan, but I believe that that whole area is just absolutely chock full of all kinds of history that we still have to discover. And so much of this, and when you come in and you're being particularly helpful here, is the oral traditions which are being kept alive by elders in villages all over KwaZulu-Natal. These are sources which haven't been taken seriously up to now.
Yeah.
And add much more color to these stories. I mean, let's just go into Dingaan just after his succeeding Shaka.
Yeah.
And what happened there?
Yeah.
You said this army was coming up from the south.
Yes, from the north.
But, tell me how it all began.
Yeah, well, I mean, Shaka had faced a number of assassination attempts already, in fact, a number which had failed. He had sent expeditions off to the Cape, diplomatic ones, attempting to consolidate the kingdom and get recognition like that. That had failed. And it seems that he sent the army up north again very quickly to get it out of the way while he tried to consolidate his position at home, and sent the major princes with it. Now, the feeling is there, well, having sent the princes off, what was he intending to do with them, hoping they'd never come back when they went off to fight Shoshangani and the Gaza people near Delagoa Bay? But what happened? The princes absconded when the army was halfway there, came back, and with Nkabai, the sister of Sinzanga Corner, who had put Shaka on his throne, she had decided Shaka was becoming too much of a problem, so she aided and abetted Dingaan and his brothers in this assassination attempt. So once that's all done, it's consolidated, the army comes back, the army's persuaded that the new king has done a good thing. The first thing the king does after that is kill almost all the rest of his brothers, about 13 or so of them.
He kept Mpande alive.
He kept about one other alive too. So there are about two brothers were left alive, but the rest were eliminated, like the Ottoman sultans, who the first thing they did coming to the throne was
or the English in the Wars of the Roses.
Yeah, you strangle all, you kill all the
Henry VIII did
you
this.
Can, yeah. You kill the opposition, sure, that's the thing. So once he's there, right, so he's set off. Now he's a successful king. He's setting military expeditions off into the Highveld to fight Mzilikazi and people like that. He is acting like now a good Zulu king, exactly in the footsteps of his brother.
And interestingly enough, establishes a permanent capital, which Shaka had never done.
Well, Shaka kept on moving his capital, then getting closer and closer to that extraneous element, those Port Natal settlers who arrive. They arrive there with weapons, they arrive there with a whole another world that's part of the whole game now. And Dingaan starts playing this. I mean, Dingaan is now using them as mercenaries. He is beginning to collect firearms. So Dingaan is getting into the colonial world. He is sending off diplomatic missions to the Cape as well to try and make for better relations. So he is also getting into the whole sort of nexus of this new kind of world where the colonial element is absolutely beginning to impinge on your kingdom and you're beginning to react to it. That's all very well dealing with Port Natal traders who every now and again you attack them, you scare them off their settlement, you control them, you go and attack Delagoa Bay and beat up the Portuguese, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, so he's very much acting like a good Zulu monarch until the guys come over the Drakensberg with Piet Retief, and then this is a whole new ball game entirely.
So did they meet as sincere equals when they decided that they were going to apportion land to each other and there was a deal on men and on arms and on cattle, or was it a complete farce?
Dingaan had already allocated all the land he allocated to Piet Retief to Captain Gardner, the missionary. It was already spoken for. It was already allocated.
And it was a sizable piece of land.
Yeah, well, it's
between the Tugela and the...
And the Mzumkulu. I mean, basically sort of, you know, sort of right down there. So, yeah, so the land...
I'm only looking because I want to make a land claim at some point. Yeah, I'm going to use the document.
Right. So already the land is bespoken for, if you like.
Right.
And when Piet Retief arrives... he breaks all Zulu etiquette. He doesn't wait for the king to call for him. He doesn't wait for invitations. He pitches up. This is in November of the year before the war actually
no
begins.
No deference shown.
No proper deference shown. And straight away, negotiations mixed with threats. Look what we have done to Mzilikazi. Look at us. God's on our side. You know, look what happens to bad kings who don't play the game according to our rules. And I think what one's got to remember right throughout this, the trekkers had all experience in the Eastern Cape frontier. That's in a way where it all begins.
Right.
We have now had 80 years of warfare, about 660 at this stage, of warfare against the Amankota. Mm. You know, so, I mean, this is where you've grown up. You've just lived through the Sixth Cape Frontier War, and treaties are part of that game. You begin treaty systems and all the rest of it. But basically, it's all an effort to get the land you want, to control the people you're fighting against, to use their labor as best you can. I mean, so all of this is already absolutely set. I mean, the Trekkers knew how to deal with Africans. They've been doing it for all this period on the Cape Eastern Frontier. And so they move into Zululand with exactly this same way of thinking about it. And the Zulu King also has a good eye. He knows perfectly well what's been happening on the Eastern Cape Frontier. He also knows what's been happening against Indibele up on the Highveld. So He knows these guys are really dangerous. He knows that they have firearms to a number which he certainly has nothing like, that they're great fighters. So this is a mortal kind of threat, you know. And when they come over the mountain straight away into his territory, without asking his permission, start collecting grain and other foodstuffs from his people as if they had conquered them already. I mean, so this is the whole situation when Piet Retief actually arrives to begin negotiating. So this guy, he is trouble, you know, from a Zulu perspective. And I mean, even if Piet Retief is saying, right, well, we'd like half your kingdom, shall we say, we'd negotiate for it, the warnings are already there. And in his own justifications to the Eastern Cape newspapers, because he's a great newspaper correspondent saying what he's doing and where he's going and what it's about, is, yeah, we're going to be peaceful, but don't let them start any trouble because we will take up arms if they do. So, you know, this is negotiation with threat. It's like Putin arriving saying, okay, we would like the Donbass free, please, you know, yeah, but don't say no.
And of course, you know, the Zulu are a different kettle of fish to the Xhosa. There's a very different kind of outlook.
Much more centralized, much more of a centralized,
a real empire,
coherent monarchy. Where the Xhosa were much more
disparate.
Exactly.
Well, so then these negotiations are going to take place under bad faith from both sides.
Yeah.
So it's doomed.
From both sides,
it's
indeed.
It's doomed from the start.
Absolutely.
The story that we all know is that they are placated, the Trekkers. They're told, here we are, Dingaan supposedly signs the Traktaat, which was found much later in his saddlebag, conveniently.
Yeah. So they say.
Exactly. and Dingaan then orders their death.
Yeah.
And this is not unlike any monarch might do to the most immediate threat.
Well, we've all watched Game of Thrones. We've seen what happens at banquets.
Banquets. So they all eat very merrily. There's dancing and singing, and then suddenly a whole bunch of Assa guys come out.
Yeah, right, yeah. But also, I mean, the Boers, when they arrive, they're given an exhibition of military prowess, right? They're firing blanks, but they're galloping around. The whole of Mgungundlovu is covered, you know, it's suffused with gunpowder. I mean, this already is a visible threat as such. And they break all kinds of taboos. I mean, they're offered the best kind of accommodation in the Akanda, in the military homestead. No, they're not going to live in huts. They're going to camp outside. And they happen to camp outside on a royal grave, you know, which is not really appreciated either. They're offered food. They say, no, we're going off hunting. So they don't want our food. They go peeking around the Isigotlo, the king's sort of harem, which nobody does on pain of death. So what's that about? They start moving around it at night, looking out for their strayed horses, so they say. But then what are they actually doing? Are they thinking of an attack? Are they measuring things up? Or,
no, if you're Dingaan, you're paranoid at this point.
And, you know, this is what wizards... I mean, when he says kill the wizards, it's because this is what wizards do. Wizards move around at night, checking out their potential victims. And so the Boers are going on like bad people with, you know... Yeah.
But there are dead bodies, so we know that he's not exactly playing the game either.
No, he's certainly not playing the game.
And this is now... full all-out war, and interesting, after their murder, he moves quite quickly, Dingaan.
The operation is, it's boom, boom, together, and look, when...
Because he realizes the rest of the party are out...
out there, and any Zulu king, when you execute an enemy, or execute one of your top people, because what the Zulu kings would do regularly, they would kill a top chief or two just to show who was boss. Mm. You would then go off and eradicate their entire family and everything around them. So
extirpation.
And so what this is, it's on a larger scale than usual, but it's you kill the chief and the army goes straight out to wipe out the rest of the extended family. So it's a typical Zulu operation.
And they're really caught with their pants down, because
And they were. I mean,
so it's remarkable anyone survived that first wave of attacks.
Absolutely. Well, again, those who'd had enough sense to lager or semi-lager were fine. Those who were scattered along the riverbanks, they had bad luck. But again, it was actually a setback for the Zulu, because here it is, they'd arrived totally by surprise, caught the encampments completely unprepared, and yet they hadn't won. They were actually fought off. They escaped they retired with a fair amount of cattle, but they hadn't carried out the operation completely. So that is another shock, if you like, for the Zulu king. The operation is not a success.
And this is where the Shaka fans would say, well, under his leadership, they might have done better.
Well, you see, Shaka, certainly by the late stage of his life, he never went into battle himself. His generals did it. His generals were going to fight the Amampondo or the Swazi or whoever. So Dingaan was simply giving his best generals. It was now in command of his absolute best guys, and Zorbo and Glel and people like that. So now he's giving it the full show, if you like.
Mm.
And this failure is something that is really, really alarming, in fact. So does this knock their self-confidence?
Put them on the back foot?
It puts them on the back foot, and what to do next. And it's the Boers who make the next move when they decide, when they pull themselves together and then raid towards Mgungunhlovu, that commando led by Asen and Potgieter. So that is the next move. And the Zulu then respond to that, and they respond successfully. It's a battle they win completely at Eleni. I mean, mm-hmm. the Boers are completely beaten up and retreat and basically flee, you know, pursued by the Zulus. I mean, that's a loser. And at the same time, at Port Natal, where the Boers have made an alliance with the hunter traders at Port Natal, they've galvanized themselves. They've put together an army mainly of African retainers, retainers and levies. I mean, it's mainly an African army, though about 500 or so of them have got firearms of one sort or another. They invade Zululand, and at the Battle of the Tugela near Ndondogazuka, they get completely wiped out. I mean, and Port Natal itself is attacked and burnt, and the survivors, you know, take refuge on a ship in the bay. So, I mean, so here are two Zulu big victories, boom, boom. So
you would think this would buoy them up for
So now they are buoyed up. So now from the Zulu point of view, by April or so, they're really pretty much in charge. And the Boers are now on the defensive. They're pulled back. They're going into their lagers and all the rest of it. And the next step is, as the Boers, what do we do? They're actually, as I say, marking time. And the Zulu then make the next initiative. We're going to finish these guys and and hit them at Fechla, you know, in August. And that is their first attack on a well-fortified lager with the game pits and all the rest of it. And they attack it again and again. And that is the real game changer. So here's the full Zulu army, but attacking this all-round defensive lagered position.
But still, I mean, the numbers are extraordinary.
Well, you know, I think one mustn't overdo the numbers, because, you know, at Fechla, the Boers were under they're about 200 at most. And the Zulu army is perhaps 5,000 or 6,000 at most. The numbers are much smaller than we like to think. That when you're fighting in Ndondogazuka, the numbers there were also about 5,000.
It's still
1,000
to 10. It's
1 to 10. But 1 to 10 in a siege situation is in fact really, you know, quite another story altogether. And the point about lagers as well is that you can outnumber 50 to 1, but if the lager length is, shall we say, 200 yards, that is only 200 yards of the 10,000, and the rest are are behind, you know. So in other words, you're concentrating against only those number that actually face the lager, and all the other huge numbers are simply in the rear.
Okay, but then that's a strategy which the Zulu weren't prepared for.
No, indeed not. I mean, they try to surround these lagers. They try and hit it at different places. And they would have known what Nsilikazi had done at Efekop, where again you're looking basically
a weakness.
You're looking for a flank to turn, essentially. Mm. You're looking to outmaneuver them, to surround them, you know, and this you couldn't do. So you try here, you try there, you try to the left, try to the right.
So do you think that battle was then the turning point?
That was the turning point, because the Zulu now thought, okay, what do we do in this sort of situation? When we've caught them in the open, as they did at Heleni and at the Battle of the White of the Tugela, that's fine. But now, what do we do? As far as the Boers are concerned, they've always known that lagers are from the wars on the Cape Eastern frontier. They've known this is the way to do it. But now this absolutely is reiterated. So if we go in and attack and we lager, we are going to win anything like this. And for the Zulu position is, how do we cope with it?
Mm.
And so Blood River, in a way, is a kind of desperate measure by the Zulu, because here is this large command under Pretorius moving in with all its wagons. And they're going to lager, and the Zulu know that this is the situation, but all they can do is put together the biggest army they've put together by this stage, 12,000, 15,000, and try and attack it and do the best they can, knowing they would take heavy casualties, but hoping that weight of numbers and sheer tenacity, they would manage to break through somewhere or other. Because with a lager, it's like a British infantry square or something.
Yeah.
You break it and you have
the
entry.
The Roman way of doing the same.
And once you break this formation, you know you've won the thing. So Blood River was this battle which the Boers really thought they should and would win, and the one the Zulus thought they must win, but doubted in many ways that they could. You know?
What time did it take place of day?
It started right in the early morning. I mean, in fact, before daylight, actually. The Zulu left wing took up position, crossed the river and took up position in the early morning, before light finally broke. And, you know, there they were positioned. But the lager was very cleverly positioned with the river on the one side and a donga on the other. So the perimeter was very narrow, in fact, so that the Zulu army could only really attack the northwest corner. And that meant that, as
they
say,
concentrated there.
They concentrated, and you know, when the next Zulu wave came, I mean, supporting the first lot who had lost out, I mean, all they're doing is adding more people behind those that are already there. And you have the Zulu situation of those behind pushing forward and those in front pushing back. And
death trap.
Death trap, absolutely, yeah. So it worked extremely successfully.
And what were those final numbers? You said, what, 15,000? 12,000?
15,000 attacking, yeah. The lager, again, one of these interesting things we forget, there were perhaps, about 470 white guys in the lager, but there were then...
Is that just men or...?
Just men, yeah. This was unlike, say, Verkop or Verla, where there were women and children. This was just men. This was just a mobile commander out to
fight. Where were the women and
children? They were left at the various other big lagers to the rear.
Okay.
So there they were, secure, with men to guard them, with strongly fortified
lagers. Because,
again,
the myth is that you've got the wives loading the guns behind the husband and the children taking shots when the husband needed a break.
Well, that is Verkop, all right. But,
right.
And Verla as well, but not this one. The people there who were helping loading were, again, the people who always get written out of the story. It's the Achterreyers who are there, who are following the horsemen. I mean, they're the guys, the wagon drivers. You've also got this contingent from Port Natal of about 60 armed armed Africans from Port Natal as well. So on top of the 470 or so white guys, you've got someone like 300 black guys in that lager who are, some of them are firing, others are holding the horses and cattle, others are loading, et cetera, et cetera. So,
well, it's like whenever we talk about Cressy or Agincourt or anything else, we mention the king and a few noblemen and everyone else
and all the peasants are there, forget
and,
it.
And all the, you know, all support staff, the operations people.
That's right. And so they actually played, and they always get written out of the story, a real positive part in this battle. And of course, this is typical of any colonial situation, that many blacks are actually fighting against other blacks. But the Zulu kingdom is their enemy, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so,
and there were many people who were quite disenchanted with the
disenchanted,
Zulu, who were black and all over South Africa.
They were refugees, etc., etc.
I mean, Shaka didn't exactly make friends with everyone.
No, anything but. This is why the oral memory of Shaka is so mixed. You know, Mr. Nice and Monster Horrible. You know, I mean, it's you get that from the Zulu side. Yeah.
And the truth's probably somewhere in between.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, all right. After Blood River, which is this a truly phenomenal victory.
Yeah, it is, absolutely.
And absolutely deserves its place in history. I like that you've also given us the Zulu name for it, Nkome.
Yeah, that's the name of the river, yeah.
Sure, but for the Zulu people, this is also a massive turning point.
Oh, it
because
is.
Now
yeah.
suddenly, they've thrown everything they could at this, and it didn't work.
Yeah, but you know, it's not the end of the kingdom, because, I mean, this is, it's, Zulu kings like, or Mzilikazi, or anyone else, these kingdoms were mobile.
Yes.
You know, it wasn't so much the land, it was the people and cattle. And kings, if they're defeated, could move off. And Dingaan's response to this, okay, I'm moving out of this area and I'm going to reconsolidate myself in northern Zululand or in Swaziland. And what's so often forgotten, the Boers actually continue after Blood River. They burn Mgungundlovu and all the rest of it. Those various other Makanda in the Emakosini. But they then move on to the White Mfolozi. And down they go, and they're ambushed in the Battle of the White Mfolozi, or, you know, Upate, as the Zulu call it. And it was a major defeat. I mean, you've got the lager on top of the Mtanjaneni Heights. You've got a commander going down into the valley of the White Mfolozi, more or less where modern-day Ulundi is. Right. And down they go. They're ambushed. And here is one of the Zulu heroes of all of this, a guy called Bongozo, who was sent deliberately into the Boer camp as spies and all the rest of it were frequently sent in, and he convinced the Boers that there was a huge amount of cattle down there not guarded. And he would show them the way down, and down Bongozo went, finally whistled and jumped into the bush off his horse where he's tied, his hands are tied off, and they fell into this ambush. And you have this long-running battle right across the right Mfolozi, across to where modern Ulundi is, and right back into the Mtanjaneni Heights, pursued by the Zulu the whole way. The guys on horses mainly get away. Those on foot, and these are about 60 or so black Port Natal levies. I mean, a whole lot of them get chopped, you know. And at the end of all of this, Andries Pretorius says, okay, we've gone far enough.
That's the border now.
No more. That's it. We're going home now. And they turn about and go home. And then they begin negotiating again about allocation of land and what, you know, if we give you peace, what we'll give you, etc.
So it's not Blood River, you were saying, but it's actually the Battle of the White Mfolozi that determines the territorial stalemate.
That's right, because after that, they're willing to negotiate. Dingaan is thinking, he creates two more Mgungundlovus. He builds two more, you know, I mean, say settling up again. And then he sends his armies north once more into Swaziland. I mean, what really changes the whole game is their defeat by the Swazi in the middle of 1839, where, okay, I can't move my kingdom any further north because the Swazi have defeated my army at Lubuye. So now I've got to talk to the Boers. Meanwhile, the British, they come into the picture because their real concern with the Trekkers is that they're going to cause mayhem on the high veld. This is going to cause more movement of people, which might hit the Cape Colony frontiers and cause new trouble. So they don't want any more stuff. So they've
like
now got
kicking over nests.
Yeah, this is exactly so. So they've now got troops in Port Natal who are trying, in fact, even before the battle Battle of Blood River, to force to persuade the Boers to negotiate with the Zulus not to have any further fighting. So the British now are playing their part in helping the Boers negotiate a territorial treaty with Dingaan. Dingaan promises to pay cattle as a fine and this and the rest of it. But to basically say, okay, we're taking this land south of Tugela, the rest is yours, you know, and so we're sort of making this kind of
non-aggression pact.
And I mean, what wrecks the Zulu kingdom is not the Boers at that stage, it's civil war, where Mpande, in fact, breaks the rope, flees to Boer territory across the Tugela, and the Boers think, right, this is great.
We'll deal with him now.
We've got this guy with a big army. In fact, we'll deal with him. He'll be our client. So we help him beat Dingaan once and for all, and we can make further deals with him, which, in fact, of course, they do once Mpande is defeated Dingaan. So they take even more territory.
And then is Mpande at that stage almost a puppet king? Because he's been mischaracterized also quite cruelly through history as having been, I mean, despite being Cetshwayo's father, he doesn't really get much of a look in history. Yeah. He doesn't get much attention at all.
Yeah. No. Well, he is in many ways the most successful Zulu king, from one way of speaking, because he dies in his bed, which is unheard of most of the others. Right, yeah. He kept the kingdom together with the Boers.
And long reign.
He kept it together under British pressure when the British took over Natal, you know. So, I mean, he actually stabilized what had left of the Zulu kingdom north of the Tugela, you know, and survived.
But what about Dingaan's end? I mean, that's also quite sad.
Well, yes. I mean, Dingaan, after Mpande defeated him, he fled, to the foothills of the Lubombo Mountains, where he again still had part of his army with him. He still hadn't given up. He still set up another royal Ikonda, usual style, but it's the local people, the Swazi and the Nyawo, who decide we can't stand this guy and we're actually going to do him in. And there's every indication, too, that many of those around Dingaan said, listen, we're not sitting in this malarial belt away from everywhere. And they called in the Swazi, said, there's the king, let's get rid of him so we can go home and acknowledge Mpande as king and get back to normal. So, but once, as they used to say, once a king goes to the mountains, he is finished. You're a Zulu king, you're a warrior king, you lose the war, you've lost it. So after being defeated by Mpande, Dingaan had really lost it. I mean, he just simply couldn't
almost
come
like,
back.
This makes me think of Cato in the desert after Caesar's won the civil war.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he decides he may as well take his own life.
Yeah, well, exactly, because there's nothing left. So now Mpande is obviously there. Dingaan is finished. I mean, he can try and negotiate and try and consolidate, but it's too much. It's too far. So,
and he doesn't have any authority anymore because now the new king is there and he's got the majority of the army.
This is right, and his people are deserting him day after day. So yeah,
and then he supposedly is killed somewhere in the Tlatin.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, I mean, again, exactly what happens to him is. But he is ambushed.
He might have just slipped away.
Yeah. Well, he built a new little royal homestead, Eskoleni, and Swazi war band took it at night. I mean, there's a lovely element there of his people smelling birds, and of course all the Swazi feather headdresses in the early dawn. But they attacked him. They killed his favorite dog. They stabbed him, and he died. And then people said, okay, we're going home now.
You know, I'd like to carry on the story from here, but I mean, your book, you've very much concentrated in that period from 1837 to 1840, which is with a huge amount of detail.
Yeah.
Because there is still a lot of detail.
There's a lot that goes on. And I mean, I've done this in previous books, in fact. Well, my eight Zulu Kings, which I did for Jonathan Ball a year or two ago, takes the story through. And also, again, a Jonathan Ball book in the 1990s, Rope of Sand, also takes the story through. So I have sort of followed it in other iterations, which is another reason for not taking it any further now. I mean, this is a, you know, this is a beginning and end. You've now got Dingaan's dead and Pandey's on the throne. The British are about to arrive. They haven't yet. So that's a place to stop.
What is it that drew you in the beginning to Zulu history?
Very obliquely, when I was at Cambridge University, my special subject was the Indian Mutiny.
Oh, yeah.
Which I very much enjoyed researching, et cetera, et cetera. Then I got a job at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Maritzburg, and you're not in any position to carry on doing Indian history. I mean, where are the archives, et cetera? Well,
there's some nice links there, yeah. I suppose.
There are lots of Indian Natal links and
absolutely.
Personnel and
Gandhi
Sal and all the rest of it. Absolutely.
Slave trade and sugar
cane.
And there are
tons of links. But then I thought, well, here is a Zulu thing. I mean, the Indian Mutiny is all about the British consolidating their rule. And here is Zululand, the British consolidating their rule. And when it came to the anniversary of the Anglo-Zulu War in 1979, I thought, right, this is a time to do it. And I and a colleague, Paul Thompson, who's now dead, unfortunately, we began doing a kind of field trips. I mean, and we thought, okay, we know about six British forts in Zululand. We ended up by tracking down and finding about 100 and something of them.
Does this actually mean you trudging around with old maps, with
aerial photographs, with the evidence, speaking to local people? I mean, so I have actually
finding bullet cases.
Yeah, absolutely. I've traipsed every corner of Zululand, you can be assured. You know,
and
of course all the battlefields as well. So that's what got one into it, and one here was something of enormous interest that just continued growing and has never gone away.
And it's a romantic place. I mean, that's
it is all right.
You can if you squint your eyes, you can almost see armies clashing across rivers.
And there are all sorts of moments when the last king, King Zwelithini, I mean, was dancing in the Isibaya at the rebuilt and on Dini and so on. You know, and they're the white royal cattle and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, yeah, and there are all these continuities. It has a great romance to it, yeah.
You know, the Zulu people have been very good at retaining mm-hmm. a great depth of knowledge about their own history, there are many other nations and cultures and people all over the world who have far more scant information about, weren't as good at recording this stuff, whether orally or else, in other ways.
Yeah. But, you know, I found it disappointing. I mean, when I used to lecture on Zulu history at the University of Natal, this is before I went off to Canada for a number of years, I'd be lecturing mainly to Zulu students, Zulu history. And what did they know about it? Like nothing, it seems. So maybe their grandfathers might remember it, but it seems to have, you know, from a younger generation, I suppose... less so if you're further up in Zululand itself, but if you've got a more urban kind of, you know, it's actually as foreign as the Wars of the Roses, quite honestly, you know.
And that is sad, but I do think there are still these pockets of extraordinary knowledge and wisdom.
And a sense of Zulu nationhood,
right,
which you have, which is very, very strong. I mean, you know, and that doesn't go away, and that's part of it. And I mean, even if it's based on myth and half-remembered history, there's an awareness there, which is certainly, you know, very viable today.
And do you think that this is all being taken a lot more seriously in the South Africa of, you know, post-1994 South Africa, where I think people before, you know, the despair I feel when I hear how few people are actually studying our history is something that's entirely a separate point.
Yeah.
But that these sorts of books that you've been working on so tirelessly, these are now being taken seriously, that they're being put into the historical record, that the historical record is being updated all the time, and that there is a degree of seriousness about it.
It is, but the sad thing is, when one talks to any publishers, the number of people reading history books, I mean, I mean, Jonathan Ball himself, I used to know well. I mean, used to bewail the fact, you know, that he would be able to sell X number of history books 30 years ago, and this is absolutely, you know, reduced so considerably nowadays.
Well, don't get me started. When I walk into a bookshop and I see that most of the books are on cooking or or romance novels, I just want to scream and run out.
No, well, that's it. Well, we know it's changed, which, of course, I'm just thinking of what we're doing now, at least is perhaps accessible to people who wouldn't read, at least. You know, it's finding another audience. You know?
Are there still areas that deserve exploration in particular Zululand? And, you know, are there things that we haven't yet uncovered? Are there perhaps places that we can still look and people that we could still talk to?
Yeah. You know, I think more recent Zulu history is what's been less covered, in fact. I mean, you know, it's sort of things tend to stop with the Anglo-Zulu War. Mm-hmm. And the later history of Zululand, the appalling civil war of the 1880s, which Jeff Guy and other people did so much. Their involvement in the Boer War, for example, which I've covered, a lot more can be done on that. But just the history of Zululand in a period under the Union of South Africa and then the Republic, you know, it's not been particularly well covered at all.
And we don't unfortunately, I mean, they've attempted to put up a kind of Zulu version of the Blood River Memorial.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's doing extremely well. I wish people were more interested, but we can't force them to be.
No, one can't. And in many ways, I mean, the wagon lager and all the rest of it on the other side still has this iconic value. I mean, a long cultural sort of embeddedness, you know, which the new Zulu Memorial across the river really doesn't quite have the same kind of resonance.
But even, I have to say, even among, you know, Afrikaans-speaking people who know tangentially about the stuff that they were forced to study at school, but there's no real attachment and love to it that there might have been before. It was passionate before. My great-grandfather was Gustav Preller.
Oh, really?
Who
wrote
the history of Mzilikazi.
Yeah, of course.
Nobody knows that name.
No, anymore.
You know? Lobengula.
No. And, you know, you're talking about history in the shops. It tends to be more recent history, more contemporary history or political history. This background history that framed everything we deal with.
It's arcane now.
Arcane, yes. That's the word.
Well, you may be writing arcane books, but I thank God for it. This is good stuff. And I can't tell you, I mean, the descriptions here of brightly colored silk dresses, dainty little hats and white shoes, stockings and gloves. And, I mean, this is just you talking about the trekkers, what they looked like.
Yeah.
I mean, I love this because, to me, you're allowing us to see, to imagine.
Yeah.
The whole picture, not just the this is how many people are on this side, this is where it took place, there's a diagram. We're actually getting to see the faces and hear the voices of these people.
Well, I try to, and I mean, this is one thing of getting down to the original sources or to the, you know, the diaries and memoirs that are written or looking at the recorded Zulu oral testimony. You do get the voices, in fact, you know, and that to me is such a vital part of it.
Well done. Really, I can't thank you enough for coming to see us this morning.
Well, thank you. I've really
enjoyed for writing
this,
the book. Thank you, John.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Gareth. Thank you. CliffCentral.com.